Welcome to The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker-Scott, and welcome back to Season 3 of The Informed Gardener. I'm here as your online garden advisor, bringing you current and practical scientific information for use in your own gardens and landscapes. Each week, I try to follow a theme throughout the podcast, and this time the theme is subarctic gardening. We've even got a Gardener on the Street segment with some quick interviews with Alaska master gardeners in Anchorage. But first, let's look at subarctic gardening in the news. Item has to do with little bunnies and the problems that little bunnies can cause in your garden and landscape. And the name of this article was Why Common Tree is Toxic to Snowshoe Hares. So snowshoe hares or snowshoe rabbits are ones that you find in the Arctic and the subarctic, and they're the cute ones that are all white and hide really well in the snow. And they're part of the food chain. They're eaten by lots of things like wolves, and they are in turn eating lots of things like things in your garden. They also happen to love to chew on tree bark, but they found out that birch bark is not one of their favorite foods. In fact, birch bark is toxic to snowshoe hares. So what the researchers did was take some chemicals from the birch and then test them on different enzymes that they know that bunnies and other animals have in their bodies. And it turns out that the birch extract binds up to an enzyme that's really important for cellular energy production. So if bunnies are chewing on birch bark, they get this chemical into their system, it binds up with some important enzymes that don't allow the bunnies to go through their metabolism, and the bunnies die. And so this is why bunnies tend to avoid birch bark. So they, instead of eating the birch bark, they will come into your garden and chew on things that don't have these toxic little compounds, and you will see their little nibble marks all around your stems and trunks. Now, I do have to say, when I was in Alaska a little bit ago, I did not see any bunny damage, but I saw lots of moose maulage. In other words, where the moose had come through and just ripped off branches and taken big swaths of bark off of trees. So I think really the moose damage is probably a bigger deal than rabbit damage. See them drifts upon the breeze, dandelions see. Now, this next item has to do with forests, and maybe you don't consider forests to be part of a garden, but we're all connected, so this is nature's garden here. And this was a big study that was done on the forests of southeast and south central Alaska. This is the area that about half of the population lives in, and about half of the timberland lives in as well. And it's a very important part of the carbon storage ability of the planet. It sequesters millions and millions of tons of carbon, and in the time that the study was done, which is more or less about 13 years, they estimated that it sequestered about as much carbon as you would get from 18 million passenger cars. So it's a lot of carbon they're chucking away, and a lot of these trees are quite old. The Sitka spruce forest can be over 200 years old, and in fact, those particular forests can store an average of 107 tons of carbon per acre. So it's a great place for carbon just to be locked away, and as long as the forests stay in good shape, then the carbon stays put away as well. I thought the most interesting part of the study, though, and this is what's going to be interesting to you as a gardener, is that the rates of noxious plants or invasive plant species invading in Alaska was pretty small. They found less than 2% of the plots they sampled even had any invasive species, which says that in Alaska anyway, it's much harder for invasive species to get a foothold. So this is kind of a nice thing for those of you that are gardening in the far north. You probably don't have the mess we do with many of our invasive nuisance species, and as long as you're not introducing any, you probably won't have those problems for a while. So take your hat off when you're talking to me, and be there when I feed the tree. Well, speaking of trees, one of the most important trees in Alaska is the yellow cedar. And yellow cedar have been historically and culturally important in Alaska for centuries. It's also a very economically important tree as well. And they've been dying off for a while, and scientists have been trying to figure out why, and now they finally have an answer. just a little bit of background. First of all, yellow cedars are a pretty slow-growing tree. They can last for hundreds of years. I've found specimens that are over 1,000 years old. The wood is very commercially desirable. It has a nice straight grain. It's durable. It's naturally resistant to rot and to insects, and so it gets used a lot for home and boat building. Native Alaskans have used it for a number of centuries as well. It's used for making paddles and masks and dishes and woven items. In fact, if you go to Alaska and look at a lot of the native crafts, you'll see a distinctive yellow color to the wood, and that's the yellow cedar. Well, this disease called yellow cedar decline has been affecting over 50%, in fact, almost 75% in some cases in forests in Alaska and British Columbia. And they hadn't been able to figure out what was causing the decline until just recently. And here's the story. So again, looking at kind of the natural history of the tree, it grows in an area that normally has snow cover for much of the year. It tends to grow in pretty wet areas and has a fairly shallow root system. So it's a tree that happily thrives in wet soils, and it's covered up with snow much of the year. Well, with climate change happening, some areas are losing their snow cover earlier, and it turns out that the snow also protects the roots from freezing. So it's a nice insulator blanket, and then if the snow disappears too quickly in the season and it's still cold, you get a frost that comes along and actually kills the roots. Now, when you look at trees, the part of them that is least able to survive freezing damage are the roots. The stems, the leaves, the wood, everything that's above ground is pretty much adapted to surviving freezing temperatures, but roots aren't. So you've got a tree that normally has its roots covered up with snow, and all of a sudden now some of these are uncovered because the snow has melted, and then they die because their roots get frozen. So now that they've been able to identify the problem, the trick is, how do you deal with it? And rather than turning this into figuring out what you do about global climate change, they're actually doing something a little more practical, which is identifying other areas that perhaps yellow cedars could be planted, where they would have a longer snowpack, or perhaps it's not as cold an area, and it would be good land for raising yellow cedars. So it's an interesting, important tree, and it looks like conservation efforts can be underway now that we finally understand why it's dying. There's a dark, well, as I mentioned earlier, I was in Anchorage, Alaska this spring. I was actually invited to be the keynote speaker for the Alaska Master Gardener Conference, which was a lot of fun, a lot of great people to meet, and my very first time ever visiting Alaska. It was a wonderful flight in. It was sunny. I was able to look out the window and just see these amazing mountains after mountains after mountains, not realizing there were so many darn mountains up there. And then once in a while, you'd see a little cleared area, or not cleared, but a flat area, and there would actually be a town or a city there. And there was Anchorage, gorgeous place, gorgeous location, and a really fun place to visit. When I was there, one of the things I was really curious about was, what's it like to garden at 61 degrees north latitude? It's much farther north than I've ever been. And yet here we've got master gardeners. Obviously they can grow something. So while I was visiting there, I chatted with some of them to find out what it's like to grow plants in subarctic conditions. And here's what they wanted you to know about gardening at 61 degrees north latitude. Oh, Anchorage.
We can grow lots of beautiful flowers here and lots of great cold weather vegetables, but the most beautiful thing we can grow is the Himalayan blue poppy, which does not do well in even warm climates. So that is our one claim to fame.
Thank you. Paul, what would you like people in the lower 48 to know about gardening in Alaska?
It's cold and beautiful.
Marilyn, would you like to tell us something great about growing plants in Anchorage?
I love it because it's so compartmentalized. Just a couple months and you're done.
And you save all that time for reading your gardening books then. Joan, would you like to tell people in the lower 48 what's great about gardening in Anchorage?
Red raspberries. And they're prolific. I have more than I can possibly use.
Well, you can send them down to me. Thank you. So, Debbie, what would you like people to know about gardening in Anchorage?
We can grow a lot of things and a lot more things than we have space for.
What's your favorite?
Probably what's blooming right now, and then the thing that's about to bloom, and all that really pretty stuff that just finished.
So, Corleen, what do you like best about gardening at Anchorage, or any place in Alaska?
I think the best thing is gardening from sunup until past midnight.
Jill, what do you like best about gardening in Alaska?
Well, I came from California, and it's really nice to have a season. So you anticipate spring, and you get everything done, and then you get to rest in the fall.
So, Carol, what would you like people in the lower 48 to know about gardening in Anchorage?
Well, there's a lot more to gardening than you expect because we have long daylight and wonderful plants that can be grown, both flowers and vegetables, that and you can extend the seasons each direction. So as we're warming with global warming, we can plant a lot of things in the zone fours now, so it makes it a lot more interesting.
So, Nicole, what would you like people in the lower 48 to know about growing plants in Anchorage?
That we have a huge moose population, and we need to choose plants that moose don't like, plants such as Nicotiana or marigolds. So you have to be very careful as a planter, and they don't like daffodils, so we plant a lot of those.
What's a moose's favorite vegetation to eat that you might have in your garden or yard?
Whatever's ready to be picked by you. Because they are there, you know, the next morning you say, that's a beautiful head of lettuce, and you go out and it is gone. So pick it early and pick it often.
So one of the things I was curious about during my visit in Anchorage was how to grow fruits and vegetables at 61 degrees north latitude. And you just heard from some of the master gardeners there about the things they can grow there, and I'm really jealous that I can't grow Himalayan blue poppies here, at least not very easily, not as easily as they can. But it's a good question. How do you grow things at a latitude where light and temperature and water can be so extreme from season to season? And when you're that high a latitude, you've got very long summer days and you have very long winter nights. And the growing season is short and unpredictable. So what do you do? Do you have enough light in the summer to have a decent growing period? During this little segment, don't worry if you're not a far north gardener, because there's going to be some really good information for you no matter where you particularly happen to live. So let's look at what happens with day length throughout the year. And this is for any place, not just in Alaska. Anywhere you live, every year on the 21st of March and the 21st of September, there are exactly 12 hours of light and 12 hours of dark. Makes no difference where you live. That's the way it is. And as you know, that's the vernal and the autumnal equinoxes. From that point on, days are going to get longer as you progress from March, or they'll get shorter as you progress from September. And the rate at which they change depends on where you happen to live. So here I am in Seattle, which is more or less 48 degrees north. And if you look at how daylight changes over a month, and let's say during the month of May, we gain about an hour of daylight from May 1st to May 31st. If you look at Anchorage, which is 61 degrees north, you actually get almost 2 hours of day length in that very same period of time. So the farther away you are from the equator, the faster that change is. At the poles, it's going to be very fast, and the equator, there's no change at all. It's always 12 hours light and 12 hours dark. So the closer to the equator, the slower the change is, and the closer you are to the poles, the faster the change is. So why is this important to plants? Well, plants key on a lot of different things for doing things like flowering or going dormant or bolting or whatever it is they do. And in flowering especially, changes in day length can be very important. Now, there's a whole group of flowers that we're going to call day neutral. That means they don't really care. If the day's long, the days are short, they just flower whenever it's warm enough. Dandelions, great example, flower all the time. But there's other things that flower in the spring or flower in the fall, and those are what we typically call short day plants. And then there's the ones that flower in the summer, and those are the ones we call long day plants. Now, for the science purists of you out there, and I include myself in that, we know that they're actually long night and short night plants, but that's a whole nother can of worms that we're just not going to open right now. So we're going to go with the generally accepted terms of short day and long day. So even though it's not exactly correct from a science perspective, we can use short day and long day to mean exactly what they say. A short day plant flowers during short days, and a long day plant flowers during long days, and that keeps it really simple. Once that critical photoperiod has been reached, plants are able to flower, set fruit, and start growing like crazy. They just have to have warm enough conditions. And as I said, luckily for Anchorage, it's a maritime environment, and they have fairly warm weather there in the summer. So they have long days, warm days, lots and lots of great weather for growing vegetables, even tomatoes. This is what people can't believe. You can actually grow tomatoes in Anchorage. We think they have a short growing season, but they actually can grow wonderful tomatoes. It turns out that a lot of the things that are native in Arctic and subarctic environments tend to be low growing or small, and they're just perfect for small urban landscapes. And so we tend to like to grow a lot of those things in our urban landscapes and gardens, especially if we happen to have fairly small yards. So if we were to grow these things down here, we'd have to be really careful on what we chose to grow. We could grow something that had day-neutral flowers. In other words, plants don't really care. If it's short day, long day, they will flower at any point in time that it's warm enough. Or they may be short-day plants, in which case they will flower happily. But if they're long-day plants and they have a photoperiod, again, of something like 19 hours, there's no way that someplace like Seattle will ever have a long enough photoperiod to actually get those things to bloom. So you have to be really careful with choosing which plants you might want to import and try that might be Arctic or subarctic natives.
I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine. There's gotta be a little rain sometime.
So now if you're able to grow some summer flowering, this is long day, Alaska native species in Seattle, what do you think might happen in terms of when they would flower? Do you think they'd flower earlier, or would they flower later than they would in Alaska? Well, if you were looking at temperature, you'd probably be right to say they might flower sooner because it probably gets warmer in Seattle faster than it does in Anchorage. But if you're looking just at the photoperiod, remember these are things that have a long photoperiod requirement, they would actually flower later in Seattle than they do in Anchorage. So that just, you know, blows the whole hole into having this short growing period in Alaska. And the reason, again, is because they reach that critical photoperiod faster in Alaska than they do Seattle. Remember, in Seattle, it takes about a month to get an hour more daylight. In Anchorage, it takes a month to get 2 hours of daylight. So just you get that longer daylight period faster. I would really encourage you to try some of these subarctic species in your garden if they're things that might tolerate a little bit warmer conditions than they're used to, but make sure that they're either day-neutral plants or short-day plants. Otherwise, you might be waiting a long, long, long time to see even one flower. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Be sure to join us next time when our theme will be Say It With Flowers. Until then, happy gardening.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. To catch this and other shows from previous seasons, go to theinformedgardener.com, mynorthwest.com, or search for us on iTunes.